Road land, both silent now. Their journey together had been a long one, as long as Sir Gilbert Kilbear had been with them, since the beginning. Half a dozen torches flickered from the great hall as the men ran across the yard towards the ramparts. Blackstone turned to Will Longdon. The approaching flames cast light across his face. Will Longdon felt something tighten in his chest, a tension that was not from the beating he had taken.
"Will," said Blackstone quietly, "when we reach Sir John, you choose the archers that he offers. Find me hard men, the best there are. I want gristle and muscle behind those bows. I want men who will use every arrow in their bag and then follow us with sword and archer's knife in their fists. I am going to rip the heart out of every mercenary company I find. I will give no quarter to these murdering scum. And when we have done that, I will find Griffith ap Madoc and William Cade, and kill them."
This was no simple threat or desire for revenge, Will Longdon realized. It was as devout a promise as a man who submitted his soul to God and became a priest. It was a pact being made with heaven or hell, and the veteran archer was uncertain which it might be.
"Sir Gilbert wants a crusade. I will give him one," said Blackstone.
Chapter 20 The peacocks at the royal manor of Vincennes screeched. King John the Good smiled with delight as they entertained him with a flourish of colour. The dismal weather was as depressing as the blanket of grief that settled over his kingdom. How had the greatest nation in Christendom been trammelled by the barbaric English? How indeed, he wondered, could he and his fellow hostages, many of whom were still held in London, had been so well and kindly treated by Edward, but returned to such desolation. It was not dissimilar from the torture that he had inflicted on his enemies, one foot in a cold bucket of water, the other in scalding. Soon it was only the cold water that was required to break the victim. This chill of despair, he felt now, was like the plunge into the cold water.
"Inus," said Bussy, "you sent for me."
"We are melancholy, Simon. We were thinking a moment ago of how cosseted we were by our cousin Edward in England, how here there is nothing but discomfort and waste. The English stroke us with a velvet glove on the one hand, and scourge us with the other."
Simon Bussy stood nonplussed. Matters of state needed to be attended to. An army of several thousand had been raised in the south, and Bretons were gathering in force in the south-east to challenge the English-backed John de Montfort. The Breton mercenaries worked in King Jean's favour. Brittany was not part of Edward's treaty, and the fiefdom was to all purposes controlled by Charles of Blois, supported by the French king.
"Sire, I am grieved to hear that, but the Bretons will pose a threat to the English, and Brittany will at least still be held for us. Meanwhile, the English are securing the towns laid down in the treaty, while routiers destroy others. Sir John Chandos will soon be here with his commissioners, and he will require the final handover to the English crown of those towns that remain."
King John nodded, but Bussy could see that his attention was elsewhere. He was gazing across the vast walled courtyard. Over the years, Vincennes had been fortified, and if one was not behind the safety of the walls of Paris, the royal manor was perhaps the next best place to be. The building work had continued over the years, and it was the king's desire that the royal family and the retinue of advisers and servants could all be accommodated.
"The fountain does not seem to flow with the same power," said the king.
"Sire," said Bussy, looking towards the centre of the courtyard where a fountain spurted.
"Do you not see?"
said the king impatiently. Bussy's age and long experience serving the king and the dauphin had schooled him in the art of showing no reaction to their capriciousness. The fountain was fed from the nearby suburb of Montreuil, and a lake had been built at Saint-Mandé to feed it. It was just one of many extravagances the king had demanded. No different, perhaps, than the keep that was still being constructed, whose four connected towers would stand 100 feet and more above the chateau. A place a threatened king might retreat into at a time of war, or a place to be incarcerated when madness finally struck. The truth, Bussy knew,
was that the huge edifice was being built to accommodate the Dauphin's art collection. Perhaps the madness was already upon them.
Inez, the weather is freezing, and perhaps one of the clay pipes has cracked. I will have workmen investigate it.
Good. We take some pleasure from it, and there is little of that to be had these days.
My lord, you sent for me. Was it to attend to the fountain?
Are you becoming senile? There are other issues to hand. We must consider our army's standing in the south, and I intend to journey there.
Fussy waited, his thoughts chasing possibilities. The king would surely not dare to take the field against the routiers. Did he still crave glory? Had not the English tarnished such endeavours?
I see, your grace.
A journey, he said flatly.
If our army has secured the south, then we have it in mind to travel to Avignon, to the Pope.
Pope Innocent VI was a Frenchman, and looked kindly on John, but to Bussy's mind there was no cause for the king to travel across what was still a war-torn France to see the Pope, no matter how successful the French army might be.
Avignon. 20,000 died of the pestilence. They say it has passed, but there is still a risk,
Bussy said.
It has passed, said the king. Now we must see the Pope.
The Pope,
Bussy said, keeping his voice free of censure.
For a blessing, sire?
Of a kind.
Bussy waited. Since the king had returned from being held prisoner in England, he had seemed incapable of finding the means to begin rebuilding France. Was it because the English king's demands were still being met, that his ransom had not yet been paid in full? Was that what stripped the volatile king of France of his energy?
We have been at prayer and reading the prophecies of the Franciscan, said the king.
Bussy's thoughts stumbled in the face of the king's fecklessness. For years John had schemed and planned and brought both high emotion and cool logic to his single-minded desire to rid France of the English. But now he was talking of fountains and a Franciscan monk. There were no Franciscans in Paris.
None at Vincennes.
De la Roquetaillade,
said the king, annoyance creeping into his voice at Bussy's dull look of incomprehension.
Merciful Christ, Bussy almost whispered.
Back in 56, a troublesome monk had been cast into prison in Avignon, just before the great battle at Poitiers. He had railed against the corruption of priests and predicted that France would be brought down by tyranny and brigands. Was the king interpreting this to mean that Edward was a tyrant? Bussy wondered. But there was no denying that after the battle, routiers had swept across the countryside, and still did, as prevalent and deadly as the pestilence itself. The Franciscan's mind might have been afflicted by starvation and privation, but he had also proclaimed that the lowly would rise up against the great. That had certainly come true. The Jacquerie uprising had slain thousands, and then Bussy thought he understood.
The Antichrist, he said. He predicted the pestilence and the Antichrist.
Do you believe, sire, he meant Thomas Blackstone?
We had news that there had been a skirmish between him and the Audrehem's men, who were forced to retreat, though we are uncertain whether their attack was deliberate or he was mistaken as a routier. He serves Edward, but
Blackstone? A common killer? He is beyond our concern or our interest, the king interrupted, and a court fool could predict pestilence.
Are we to relegate you, that role, Simon? Do you have no comprehension?
De la Roquetaillade predicted, after the chaos and poverty, once our chastisement had been endured and against all known custom, that the King of France would rise to power again and be elected as the Holy Roman Emperor, to rule as the holiest monarch since the beginning of time. Such an emperor would cast out the Saracens and Tatars from Europe, and would convert the Muslims, Jews, and all other heathens. Simon, heresy would be conquered.
Anxiety gripped Bussy. Was the King of France losing his mind? Prophecy was one thing, but to conjure reality from it another. Events swept across a nation, and it was easy to attribute superstition to such times.
Ines, I do not understand why you would need to visit the Pope. If our merciful Lord Jesus Christ meant to bestow such a blessing on you, he faltered, the incredible thought slowing his speech, then surely the Pope would know, would he not? A king rules by divine providence, but a pope is God's representative in this world.
Even a king cannot force the hand of God, Simon, said John.
One must exercise patience. For some time now we have been a widower, and such grief is not unlike experiencing the death of France.
Sire, France lives. She is wounded, but she can be healed by your hand.
Wounds heal slowly, Simon.
We thought that we should bring together France and Provence. Do you see? Slowly but surely, we will ready ourselves for the future.
Like watching a stonemason turn a rock in his hand to fit it correctly into a dry stone wall, Bussy saw a piece of the puzzle fit. The Pope and Avignon were in the territory of Provence, which was ruled by Countess Joanna, Queen of Naples, and Naples was a fief of the papacy. If King John wished to marry the Countess, then he would need the blessing of the Pope, and that seemed unlikely. The Pope would see Provence being absorbed into French territory as a threat. The king would also, Bussy admitted to himself, need the hand of God to protect him. Joanna had already been twice widowed, and, rumour had it, by her own hand.
A marriage and also to take up the cross and fight the Saracens.
Money and honour, said Bussy, as if thinking aloud. But, Highness, how does that help France, if you are not here to rule? King John the Good looked at his trusted counsellor.
When France rises from her sickbed and breathes freely again, I will lead her to glory.
Bussy felt the grip of fear clutch at his bowels. The king was going to abandon France to her fate. He bowed.
I will begin to look into the journey, Highness.
He turned quickly on his heel, fist clutching his cloak to his chest, desperately trying to keep his pounding heart from escaping. Only the Dauphin had the cunning and the foresight to save France, and if he had such plans, then Bussy would heed the advice given to him earlier. The Dauphin would one day take back what the English had seized, and Simon Bussy would side with him. And if the Dauphin had a plan to stop Thomas Blackstone, then he would embrace that as well. The way ahead was clear. Now there was hope. Part 2. The Valley of Sighs. January 1362. Chapter 21. Blackstone and the men left Saint-Bernice and followed the churned earth left by the brigands who had slaughtered the villagers and the lord of the manor, along with his wife and every living thing within its walls, except for Alain de la Grave. Blackstone had the boy's parents buried, despite the hard ground, and covered the shallow grave with rocks to keep the predators from digging up their remains. The creatures that came out of the forest had enough to feed on. The torn earth led Blackstone and his men across the steepening ground for 2 days until the tracks were swallowed by woodland. In the distance, mountains peeped above the miles of dense trees. It would have been madness for so few men to follow the killers. With another day's ride eastwards, they smelled the smoke of campfires before they crested a rise and saw the host gathered by Sir John Chandos. There were a few banners snapping in the bitter wind, and the smoke was lifted and carried away quickly. Here and there tents were pitched for those lucky enough to have them. Makeshift rails had been made to tether horses, and Blackstone saw that Chandos had secured the rising ground to his advantage. Sentries huddled in groups rather than single men at various posts. If a surprise attack were made by the Bretons, these groups would quickly form up. A fact quickly demonstrated as Blackstone and Kilbert rode across the skyline, and a company of men levelled their pikes and locked their shields. A cry went up.
"Riders!"
Blackstone kicked the bastard horse, side on, so that the shield slung from his saddle was seen by the sentries. One of the men lowered his shield.
"It's Sir Thomas!"
The others followed his example. Their faces, deep-etched with tiredness and campfire smoke, creased into grins. The man who had recognized Blackstone stepped forward. He was sturdy, thick-set and full-bearded. He looked to be a veteran. His clothing, mail and weapons, the knife and battle-axe tucked easily to hand in his broad belt, snug against his torso, proclaimed a man comfortable in the field of conflict. His was a hard-worked body. Used to long days without food, and Blackstone thought steadfast and efficient in a fight.
"My lord, we heard you were coming. A man of your rank and reputation is welcome."
"I'm as common as any man here," said Blackstone.
"Aye, my lord," said the man, "that may be. But these sons of whores are what you would scrape off the bottom of your boot. They stink, rank with sweat and dry hog shit from sleeping rough. Were it not for our king's payment, most would be off looting. You might be common, Sir Thomas," the man grinned, "and I dare say your stench is no better than ours, but believe me, my lord, you might as well be the Archangel Michael compared to this lot."
He turned to the ragtag bunch of fighting men behind him. They jeered with good humour. Blackstone was reminded of the vast army that he and the others had once been a part of, and how the men, insolent and ribald, gave no man their respect until he had earned it. Blackstone grinned at them.
"I'll be glad to have them at my side, rather than under my boot," said Blackstone.
"And now that you're here, we might just stay," shouted one of the men. "We've a seneschal leading us, and he's a whip for a tongue, hard on his men, Sir Thomas."
The criticism of the man designated to lead them into battle raised a murmuring of agreement.
"What of Sir John?" asked Kilbert.
"He's here. We'll take you and your men to him. But he's handing over command, that's all I know."
"Sir Gilbert," one of the men called, "I was with Cobham, at Blanchetac. I saw you there."
"You got your arse wet wading across, then," said Kilbert.
"And my blade, with French blood.
The king said the fish would all speak French after that,"
shouted another.
"That's how much blood we spilled."
The man who stood before Blackstone raised a hand.
"All right, gobshites, look to your duties. We don't want Sir Thomas thinking that talk is all you're good for."
He looked up at Blackstone and Kilbert.
"They're good men, everyone gathered here across these fields, and they'll fight hard for someone they trust," he said.
His meaning was clear.
"And do they fight for you?" asked Blackstone. "If they do not, then they get a boot up their arse. Most were at Poitiers with my Lord Warwick. We know you held the hedgerow that day, Sir Thomas, you and Sir Gilbert."
"It was a day to remember," said Kilbert.
"And never forgotten," said the soldier.
"Take me to Sir John," said Blackstone, and nudged his horse forward. As they walked the horses through the scattered men, those who recognized the shield and its motto, "Defiant unto death," stood with respect. And as those men stood, then the murmur whispered across to others who glanced towards the new arrivals, and they too got to their feet. There were those who had not fought at Crecy, and some not even at Poitiers, but they had all heard of the man who had fought in every great battle, and they wanted to see whether Thomas Blackstone's appearance lived up to his legend.
"No bowman," said Will Longdon, scanning the scattered troops. "Not a bloody archer in sight, Thomas."
"Then that means you'll have to work harder," said Moulin. "And about time," added Perrine.
"The only time I saw Ville work up a sweat was in that brothel a month back," chirped Renfred.
"Sir Thomas?"
"A horseman."
The German pointed to a man-at-arms weaving his horse through the troops on the ground. Blackstone recognized the man's blazon of 5 scallops set against a black cross. And when he reined in, he saw it was Bayard,
Lord de Grailly's captain, the man who had escorted him across France when he had returned from exile in Italy. De Grailly, the Captal de Bruch, was one of the greatest Gascon knights, and held the hereditary title of Master of Gascony. If the Captal was here, then there could be no doubt of who would lead the fight.
"Bayard," said Blackstone, "good to see you again." "And you, Sir Thomas," said the Gascon. "I would come closer and offer you my hand in friendship and welcome, but I remember your horse is of ill temperament."
"Well remembered," said Blackstone. "The Captal is here?"
Bayard shook his head. "More's the pity. He's now counsellor to Charles of Navarre. They are tucked up in the Pyrenees. Navarre had a hereditary claim on Burgundy, but he's been forced to think again. It's politics, Sir Thomas, a plague on us all. Sir John is this way."
The soldier stepped back.
"Good fortune, Sir Thomas. Captain Bayard can take you on to Sir John."
"Your name?" said Blackstone.
"I am Ralph Tate."
"Then, Master Tate, I will see you again." Sir John Chandos stood before a modest tent and a glowing brazier. He was as grimy as any of the men, and like them he looked weary. Drizzling rain had started again, and the damp smudged the furrowed lines on his forehead. A face ploughed by the responsibility of being the king's negotiator in France. Blackstone nudged the bastard horse towards one of the wooden stakes with an iron eyelet hammered into the ground. Kilbert did the same, but kept his horse out of kicking distance of Blackstone's mount. They dismounted and tethered the horses.
"Bayard, now we'll call the captains before dark and give them my orders." "Have yours ready," said Chandos.
The Gascon acknowledged the great knight's command and spurred his horse. The moment he was out of earshot, the king's vice-chancellor in France changed his tone.
"You took your time. You're damned late. Another day and we would have been gone from here."
"We'd have followed the stench of your latrine pits," said Kilbert.
"Gilbert, I swear it's you I blame for making Thomas Blackstone so damned independent in thought and action."
"I taught him everything, John, especially how to not give a pig's arse for authority other than the king's."
"And the prince," said Blackstone, "when he lets me give a pig's arse, when he doesn't exile me or strip away the towns I fought for, when he's had a good night's sleep after a bellyful of good Gascon wine, then he and I get along, until the next time we fall out."
"Honour is a tenuous thing, John," said Kilbert. "We offer it to men who often don't appreciate it."
Chandos handed them two beakers of wine. "We're soldiers. No one said it was going to be exactly as we wanted. Which is why," he looked at Blackstone, "we need discipline." He poured more wine into his own beaker. "He disobeyed me, Gilbert, to go off and find you. I told him you weren't worth the effort, that you would already be dead, that there were more important battles to fight."
Kilbert nodded. "Quite right. Which brings us back to that pig's arse. John, we fight for each other. Nothing will change that."
Chandos addressed Blackstone. "So you killed the bastard who captured Gilbert?"
"I did that myself," said Kilbert, "and then we burned the town."
"It was to be held," Chandos berated them.
"No.
It was a punishment for betrayal," said Blackstone, helping himself to more wine and then topping up Kilbert. "And Saint-Bernice is abandoned as well. Routier's slaughtered everyone, men, women, and children, and the lord of the manor.
Holy Mother of God! The king is inheriting a wasteland. He needs every town he can get."
"Not those two," said Kilbert.
"We lost one of our own as well," said Blackstone. "We came across French troops, the Audrehem's men. They either mistook us for routiers, or the King of France still has a warrant out for my death."
"They saw your blazon," said Chandos.
"I believe so."
Chandos gave the news some thought. He shook his head.
"No, Thomas. King John knows you ride with me, and that you serve Edward. See it as an error.
"Aye, an error that would have made us crow food," said Kilbert. "They knew who they challenged." "Then most likely it was a knight or some such who bears a personal grudge against you. God knows, there are enough Frenchmen who would like to see you dead. But they backed off, did they? So, you see, they saw you were Edward's man." "No, it wasn't that simple. We fought enough of them to make them run, but that was because they thought us reinforced by a few hundred routiers led by a Welshman, Griffith ap Madoc. We both know him from the old days, but he had been bought off by the bastard at Saint-Aubin to ride against the likes of us. I planned to bring him here to fight with us and promised him payment."
"Then where is he? 300 could sway the battle."
"We were betrayed by the man you gifted us, William Cade. He told ap Madoc about the gold we carried from Saint-Aubin. They took 2 hostages, so we couldn't pursue them. They hanged one of our archers. Cade took his men with the others. I intend to find him, get back the gold, and kill Cade and the Welshman." Chandos grunted and poked the charcoal. "There's scum everywhere. Cade was a freebooter. He raided around Paris. He fought for whoever paid the most, even the French. It's what men do. How else are any of us to live if we don't sell our sword?"
"And you got rid of him by putting him in my company," said Blackstone.
"Don't complain. It was worth having in a fight." "He's a man who takes pleasure in inflicting pain," said Blackstone. "He would torture a wounded man to death. He was more than scum, and you put him among us. It was his choice. He and his men came to me when I left Paris after the first negotiations. I didn't gift him, Thomas. He asked to join you once I offered you men." Kilbert glanced at Blackstone and then said, without concern in his voice, "Aye, well, he couldn't have known we were taking towns in the Limousin."
"He seemed to know," said Chandos. "He asked if I were joining forces with you. I thought nothing of it."
"Should I have done?"
"No.
He probably thought there was some glory to be had by riding with Thomas," said Kilbert, brushing aside any doubts Chandos might have had. Chandos grunted and nodded vaguely towards the troops. "There's enough food for you and your men for a couple of days at least."
"We have enough to look after ourselves," said Blackstone. "As you like. Have your men camp behind us on top of the slope, Thomas."
"Where are your bowmen?"
"Up there.
50 of them, no more. But they are well sighted for any attack that might come. They'll buy us minutes' grace, if need be."
"Is there a sentinel?"
"No. A ventener commands them."
"You're 50 and mine. I have a sentinel who knows how best to use bowmen."
Sir John looked towards Will Longdon and quickly identified the veteran who rode ahead of the archers, his war bow and its waxed linen bag across his back.
"Tell my ventner you are to command them. His name is Quesnel."
Blackstone turned to the men behind him. "Will, you heard Sir John. Work with his archers. Moulin, Renfred, Perrine." He nodded at his captains, who turned away their horses without needing to be told what to do, well-versed over the years as they had become.
"Alain, go with the men," he told the young Frenchman.
"And him?" said Chandos.
"Saint-Bernice. It wasn't just the village and manor house pillaged. They also slaughtered his parents.
He can ride with us. He's old enough to fight, and he has bad blood for the killers. He's the lord of Saint-Bernice now, and he signed it over to us for what it's worth." Blackstone took a deep draught of his wine. Kilbert warmed his backside against the brazier.
"Who do you have?" asked Blackstone.
"William Felton, who is Seneschal of Poitou, and Louis de Harcourt. They are the main commanders."
"How many men?"
"Between us we have 1,000.
"Against?"
Chandos shrugged. "De Harcourt and Felton are out there now patrolling with their men. But my estimate is that there are 2,000 Bretons, and they won't be dislodged easily."
Kilbert swallowed the last of his wine.
"On the king's last campaign, Felton got himself captured at Reims, but he escaped. It was said he broke his parole."
"He's a miserable
bastard. Hard-nosed Northumbrian. But the king likes him well enough.
"A man back there said he's in command," said Blackstone.
"I'm due to return to Vincennes and continue negotiations for the handover of the remaining towns."
"Then we stay with Felton," said Gilbert.
Chandos pulled out a folded document. The wax seal had been broken. He poured both men more wine.
"King's orders. I'm to do the talking, Thomas, and you the fighting."
He gestured with the folded document. "He's in command. But you know this countryside, so you're to advise him."
Chapter 22
Blackstone and Kilbert walked their horses towards Blackstone's men encamped on the high ground.
"Thomas, you know that Felton will piss his breeches with frustration. He'll be obliged to listen to the advice of a man who's socially inferior. Handle him with care."
"I will," said Blackstone, "but he's got a reputation of having the heart of a lion and being unafraid of death."
"Aye, and that'll make his pride ready to burst like an overripe grape if you challenge him."
"I'm hoping Louis de Harcourt will side with me."
"A blood enemy of Edward now fighting for him?"
"He might not.
His brother became your tutor and friend after Cressy, but Louis never came across to join our ranks. No matter that he now takes payment from Edward, he might think you turned his brother back then."
"And didn't. The family was already split."
"God's tears! I hate family quarrels."
"Be thankful you don't have one."
Gilbert grunted and said, "William Cade seemed intent on joining us, Thomas. Is there more to it, do you think?"
"Perhaps. If he was near Paris, who knows who paid him."
"But why kill one of our lads?"
"To make me come for him."
"Aye, that makes some sense. But it won't be to draw you away from fighting the Bretons. It's more than that."
"Then, when we find him, we'll find out."
"And while we're talking about distrust," Kilbert said, "keep an eye on Chandos. His shit isn't covered in gold. He takes handouts, you know."
"He's the king's vice-chancellor in France. He's Edward's negotiator. Why would he do that?
He has power and prestige enough."
Kilbert spat. "When I dragged your ass ashore all those years ago, you were as dumb as blood pudding. Haven't you learned anything? Do you not listen to gossip and rumour and then apply your mathematical skills as a stonemason and divide up the percentage of what are lies and what's truth?" "Edward gave Chandos old Godfrey de Harcourt's castle at Saint-Sauveur-la-Vicomte. That's the stronghold that contains the Contentin.
You remember that, don't you?
Whoever commands that has the key to invade Normandy. Charles of Navarre has fiefs in Normandy, and guess who pays Chandos to look the other way when Navarre's men raid and harass the French?"
"If that's what Chandos is doing, then it's because the king wants it."
"Oh, I'm not saying the king isn't playing a double game. He promises the French there will be no Englishman raiding while his chief negotiator turns a blind eye. When have I ever loved the French? I hope they rot, and one day we rule this godforsaken place we fought so hard for. What I am saying is do not trust so easily."
"Gilbert, Sir John's reputation is renowned. Look at the responsibility he's been given.
He landed with 60 archers and fewer than 40 men-at-arms, and, but within days, he added a further 40 hobelars. Between him and Louis de Harcourt, they've now raised 1,000 men.
We couldn't do that."
"Because we don't have the king's warrant or money. All I am saying, Thomas, is that when these damned glory hunters get a command ripped out of their hands, they can cause trouble. If they ignore your advice, you're the one in the pig shit."
"Gilbert, when I was a young archer, you taught me that without honour we are nothing. We will follow Sir John because he is the king's loyal servant, and we serve a king."
Kilbert sighed and rubbed a hand across his whiskers. I taught you well, right enough. Still, no harm in keeping eyes and ears open." As they reached the top of the slope, John Jacob came forward and took the bastard horse's reins. It immediately lurched and tried to bite him, the big yellow teeth snapping. But Blackstone Squire had long since learned how to handle the belligerent beast, and quickly brought it under control.
"There's trouble with Sir John's archers," he said, nodding to where Jack Halfpenny and Will Longdon stood facing a bunch of Chandos's bowmen, who looked angry.
Blackstone and Kilbert strode quickly towards the men.
"Jack? What's going on?"
said Kilbert.
"Sir Gilbert, these men accuse us of betraying Peter Garland," said Jack Halfpenny, one hand resting on Will Longdon's arm. Will looked as though he would strike at the man opposite him at any moment. One of the belligerent archers stepped forward and faced Kilbert, who was a couple of steps ahead of Blackstone.
"Tonight, we gave young Garland into your care, and this man," he pointed at Will Longdon, "tells us that the lad and him were taken, but that he escaped. No sentinel runs from his men, and will not be led by a coward."
Will Longdon's archer's knife was in hand before anyone realized, except Moulin, who had anticipated violence and was standing close by. He snatched Longdon's arm and blocked the archer's lunge. Longdon stepped into a wall of muscle and bone.
"Easy, Will," said Moulin. "The man provokes a fight," he added, glancing at the accuser, who had his own knife in hand, "without knowing the man he challenges."
"Enough," said Kilbert, and cuffed Longdon's accuser, who stumbled backwards, but had the good sense not to retaliate. "If you want to know about that boy, you speak to any one of our captains, and they will tell you the same story as Will Longdon here. He was hanged by the man who rode with you, William Cade, and it is he who set his men on our archers, and it was they who damned near killed this man here. He fought to save Peter Garland. Know this and live with the knowledge, and then you serve under his command. Understood?" The men muttered their understanding and agreement.
"Your name?" demanded Kilbert of the archer. "I'm Richard Quinnell, Ventnor to 20 of these men."
"Then you shall remain so," said Blackstone. "You and Jack Halfpenny both," he said, pointing to his own man, "and serve under Will Longdon."
"I will, Sir Thomas. I thank you," said Quinnell, dipping his head in respect for Blackstone, and in gratitude for retaining his rank.
Kildare's pockmarked face scowled as he and Blackstone turned away.
"Mother of Christ, Thomas! We must choose our own men, and not be put upon.
I would not be surprised if, when the time comes, these archers put an arrow in our backs."
"You're the one who struck him, not me," Blackstone grinned. "I'll make sure I'm nowhere near you when the fight comes, just in case his aim is off."
Sir William Felton was getting on in years, thought Blackstone, as he attended the gathering of captains. Probably, he guessed, in his 50th year, though it made no difference. Kilbert was about the same age, and as aggressive in a fight now as he had been years ago. Blackstone studied Sir William. He came up to Blackstone's chest, and the two lines of his blazon, ranged against a red background on his surcoat, seemed to stretch as he drew a deep breath. He scratched grubby fingernails across his weather-beaten face, where pig-bristle whiskers sprouted.
"2 days, no more," said Felton,
as he pointed with a stick at a crude model of the landscape that stood between Sir John's force and the Breton horde.
"At least 2,000. They're disciplined, well-fed, and well-led. I couldn't make out whose banner led them, but I recognized some who had been at Poitiers. These horsens will give us the fight of our lives."
He looked at the men gathered around him. Louis de Harcourt stood next to Chandos. In contrast to the squat, muscular Felton, de Harcourt was almost as tall as Blackstone, his gaunt, sunken features etched around a hawk-beaked nose. He looked to be the most noble of everyone present, and when he spoke, it was with a quiet authority, his Norman accent reminding Blackstone of de Harcourt's uncle, Godfrey, who had abandoned the family to fight for England. It was Louis's brother Jean who had befriended Blackstone. Seeing de Harcourt lifted the trapdoor to 1,000 memories in Blackstone's mind.
"They come in 2 columns, half a league apart," said de Harcourt.
"They are organized.
Scouts are a league ahead, mounted crossbowmen on each flank. Not many. I saw 2, perhaps 300. Like us, the men-at-arms wear no heavy armor, and I saw nothing of their plunder."
"Sir William?" he said, deferring to the English knight.
"Aye, they have it. 100 men or so guard it at the rear. Pack horses, mostly, and a few carts. Supplies and plunder."
He looked to Chandos. "I recommend we ride hard and get further north of them.
He pointed to the bits of rock and sticks that represented their proposed route and battleground. There, beyond the mountains, on the reverse slope, and we'll secure the heights. The men murmured their approval.
That's your decision, William. I depart for Vincennes in the morning. I'll take 50 men as escort and leave the archers with you.
Felton turned to the gathered captains.
Order a march. I'll take the right flank, De Harcourt the left, and...
He glanced at Blackstone.
You'll take the vanguard.
Kilbert grinned with anticipation, but Blackstone simply nodded. Felton seemed to be waiting for an answer.
You make no comment, Sir Thomas.
I was wondering why you would race to meet them.
We exhaust ourselves and our horses. The land here is already hard going. We have come a long way east, and the freezing air spills down from the mountains. We don't know the ground there, but a few miles from here there's a monastery. It sits high in the land. Its vineyards will be in ruins, but there's a river that feeds a lake, and there's marshy ground that could be to our advantage. The Bretons are looking for a fight, and they come straight for us. We hold the vineyard and divide our force, and we have them in a pincer. They would have no choice but to attack uphill and try and fight through the terraces. If they wheel away, the lake and marshland are on one flank and the rest of us on the other. They would be forced into a bottleneck. They would have no escape.
There was a stunned silence for a few moments. Felton's face coloured. Blackstone had embarrassed him in front of the captains. He glanced around and saw on the men's faces that they thought Blackstone's proposal to be better than his plan.
"I know the monastery," said Louis de Harcourt, breaking the awkward moment. "It sits above a place known as the Vallée des Soupirs. Blackstone is correct. The vines will have rotted, but the stakes will be there, and the terraces are steep."
Felton ground his teeth, but he held back the curse that festered on his tongue. Such rodeons had proved successful in battle before. The contours of those ancient terraces had helped funnel the French onto English swords at Crecy. Is that what Blackstone remembered? One great victory, one day's slaughter? If that was all Blackstone could offer by way of a military strategy, then his reputation as a successful war leader was undeserved.
"It is a plan that has no guarantee of success," said Felton. "My route puts us directly in their path. It will be done with, once and for all. It serves our king's wishes to destroy these Bretons. It will take Charles de Blois another 2 years at least to gather such a fighting force again. I will guarantee they will turn onto the road and have no choice but to face us," said Blackstone.
"Guarantee?" Felton scoffed.
"There is no guarantee in war. Only that a wrong decision will lead to defeat. I know this place, and I know how to force their hand. Half a day's ride instead of two, and onto ground that will give us victory."
He glanced at Louis de Harcourt.
"The nature of the ground is often of more consequence than courage. De Harcourt guffawed. Vegetius, the precious book my brother loved. He taught you well."
He laughed again and nodded. "Yes," remembering his own studies, and quoted further from the ancient book of war.
"And if your forces are few in comparison to your enemy, then cover your flanks with a city, the sea, or a river."
The men looked at Sir William Felton. He had been defeated. He glowered at Blackstone.
"Your name will be tarnished forever if we are defeated. And yours will be praised when we win," said Blackstone.
Chapter 23 Winter sun crept across the landscape, just as a fawn might ease itself into the open from the depths of the forest, cautious and unwilling to challenge the chill air that persisted beyond the trees. There was insufficient cover for men to hide in ambush close to the forest edge, so Will Longdon was obliged to settle his archers 40 paces back into the trees. It would mean a muscle-cramping night. No fires would be lit, for their smoke would linger in the high branches, which would be spotted several miles away. But there would be no complaint, or at least none spoken aloud. The men's curses would be reserved for the men-at-arms who slept beneath their blankets, sheltered from the wind by the craggy ground behind them. No doubt the damned knights would have fires. The wind favoured them,
blowing their smoke away downwind from any approaching enemy. Bastard hobelars, bastard knights, bastard noblemen, every bastard man-at-arms who waited to kill those that the archers would force onto their blades. Will Longdon had left Jack Halfpenny with his 20 archers on the slopes with Kilbert, where they would face the initial assault when the Bretons charged uphill. Halfpenny's men were in the safest position. Down here in the forest, Longdon was not content to let the archers sit in what little comfort was offered by the leaf mould blanketing the forest floor. 1,000 years had softened the ground, and despite the damp, it was a bed that offered some comfort. "Off your asses," Longdon told them. "We put ourselves at risk being here. There are enough horsemen to turn and ride through us once we shoot into them." Longdon and Quesnel set their men to sharpening stakes 30 paces back from the forest edge. The archers would be able to step forward of them and hold their ground, but if a charge came their way, then they could sprint behind the sharpened stakes, which would be hidden from view until it was too late for the riders to see them. The slender boughs, dug in at an angle, would pierce a horse's chest, and the archers would set on the fallen riders with knife and sword. They could not dig pits to entrap the horses forward of the tree line, as that would have given the ambush site away. The archers were few in number, but they could lose several hundred arrows in the first minute. The shock of sudden and near silent death from the sky would throw the mounted troops into disarray. Some would charge forward towards the high ground where the English and Gascon men waited. Others would surely turn and charge the archers. The risk was how many Bretons would be courageous enough to attack. Will Longdon nursed the fear in his stomach. His archers would have a chance if only 100 or so charged into the trees. 30 or more would go down on the stakes. The rest would hurtle after them, and that's when the lightly armed bowmen needed help. It would be a lung-rasping run to the other end of the forest into the clearing, and then they would need to steady their breathing and turn to face the Bretons. Will Longdon prayed that Perrine's men had placed the extra sheaves of arrows there for them, and that Perrine had not spotted any more buzzards circling. The raptors had faced a hard winter and scoured the land for food, but today they would abandon their hunt and be calling up men's souls. Longdon glanced up at the rising ground. There was no sign of movement, except from crows in the sky. Nothing seemed untoward, nothing suspicious that would alert the Breton mercenaries. With luck, the killing would be efficient, and his own losses few. He blew snot from his nostrils and wiped the sweat from his face as he sharpened another stake. The narrow valley would lead the Bretons towards those who waited on the higher slopes, where a small lake fed into a river. The ever-resourceful Benedictine monks, now absent, having abandoned the monastery during the winter when the routiers came through, had created the catchment area from the mountain runoff that fed down onto the lower hills. It served as a reservoir that gave them fish to eat, and its cleanliness was assured because it was the river below the monastery that carried away offal from the animals butchered in their kitchens, and ordure from their latrines. In order to control the water level, they had built a sluice that released the excessive winter snow melt. The reservoir was the length every peasant used to measure his field, 220 yards. But unlike the ploughman's acre, the dam was as broad as it was long. The monks had used the natural saddle of the land to trap the water by building a stone wall between the rock face that jutted forward on either side to secure the sluice gate. The irrigation channels for their crops and vines were controlled by small wooden gates, barely as wide as a man's spread hand. If the monks did not control the winter flow of water, then the dam would overspill. The irrigation ditches would founder, and the retaining wall crumble beneath the water's pressure. At the base of the sluice gate, a small opening allowed a steady stream of water to pass. This fed down into the river, and served to keep the water level fairly constant.
"You're certain you can do this?" said Louis de Harcourt, as he stood with Blackstone and Kilbert on the high ground, looking down across the lake and the flowing river.
Will Longdon's archers were a long way below in the forest. If the Bretons were trapped between the trees and a sudden fast-flowing river, then their choice would be to try and turn into the forest and face an unknown number of archers, or to surge upwards and assault the men-at-arms who held the high ground. Blackstone knew it was a gamble which the enemy might choose. If all went as planned, the Bretons would be split, some on one side of the river, others beyond it. Whatever happened, his plan would disrupt the larger force. But Felton was correct. There were no guarantees.
It can be done. I have already been down there. Once we open that sluice gate, the Bretons will be trapped. The river will flood, and the marshland beyond the turn in the row will be swamped after they bring their horses across the ford. It's shallow enough now, but not when the water reaches it. We will trap many of them this side. Those in the rear will be slow to turn with the supply wagons and pack horses. We take those after the fight.
Blackstone's eyes were on the fighting ground. He was taking a risk, and if he got it wrong, then his men would die, and Sir William Felton would make certain all the blame for the failure of destroying the Breton horde fell squarely on his shoulders. De Harcourt studied the younger man. He couldn't remember whether he had ever seen him at Castle De Harcourt many years ago, during those days when the family was split between serving France and England. A time when his brother Jean de Harcourt had taught Blackstone the skills of the sword after his bow arm had been broken. He shook his head, knowing he had not. Blackstone glanced at him. "You doubt me?"
"No, I was thinking of something else."
Blackstone nodded, accepting the explanation. His concentration back on the small lake and the sluice gate. Timing was everything.
"You cannot turn the sluice gate wheel."
"The handle is missing," said de Harcourt.
"I go in the water and haul on the chain." "That's too much for one man, even a man as strong as you. It cannot be done."
Blackstone grinned and gestured towards Moulin, who was organizing the hoblars into their battle positions. "Moulin will be in the water with me. Two of us can do it." Louis de Harcourt knew that Moulin had been a sworn man to his brother, but when the French king had executed him for treason, then Moulin had sworn allegiance to Blackstone.
"Our families are still linked, even by the men who fight."
"All right," said de Harcourt, accepting that there was no more to be discussed. "I will be on Kilbert's left. I pray you do not freeze to death in there, and that when you open the sluice, that the water does not take you with it. You and Sir William stay hidden until Gilbert calls for you, my lord. That way the Bretons will see only him and his few men. They'll think the heights are lightly defended. Then, when you break cover, stand fast with Sir Gilbert. Moulin and I will join you once we are out of the water. Gilbert has men ready to hold us with ropes we will tie about us." Blackstone grinned. What could go wrong? Chapter 24 Renfred sat astride his horse, 2 miles from where Blackstone and the men waited. The wind whispered up the valley and swept around forest and ancient vines. It was, Renfred realized, a sigh rather than a ghostly moan. And the valley had rightly earned its name. He kept his cloak tight around him, grimacing at the thought of another winter in France and hoping that Blackstone would take them south, perhaps even back to Italy. For summer, at least. Winter everywhere was the bane of a fighting man's life, and Blackstone fought throughout the year. Renfred's eyes glistened from the snap of wind, but he was thankful that the rain clouds seemed to falter in their journey towards him, and settled across the distant mountains. The forests shimmered in the wind, but so, too, did the horizon at the end of the valley road. He wiped his eyes, turned his head slightly to one side to settle his vision, and then looked again. Had it been the height of summer, he might have considered the wavering body of men that appeared to be an illusion created by heat haze. The enemy were in sight. The 2 columns of Breton routiers had come together across a broad front and rode steadily towards him. If Sir William and Louis de Harcourt had been correct in guessing their number, then of the 2,000, at least several hundred breasted the valley. And given the breadth of the valley, that meant that they would ride ahead in 3 waves, one behind the other. Renfred grinned. As the valley narrowed and the river flooded, they would be forced to merge ever tighter,
knee to knee on horseback, cursing and berating horse and man, forced to do Thomas Blackstone's bidding. He turned his horse and spurred it away. John Jacob stood at Kilbert's side.
"There,"
he said, pointing to where Renfred signalled. "I see him," said Kilbert. "They've entered the valley." He called and looked across to where Jack Halfpenny's men crouched on the other side of the lake. The hurdles that Blackstone and Kilbert had ordered built nestled against the old vine supports on the top three terraces. Anyone looking up onto the rising ground would see nothing more than overgrown and abandoned vines, but as many men as possible crouched behind the hurdles. The others waited on the reverse slope, where the horses were tethered out of sight.
"Thomas,
make ready," he said to Blackstone and Moulin. Stripped down to shirt and hose, Blackstone and Moulin eased into the dam, gasping with the pain of the icy water.
"Mother of Christ!"
wheezed Moulin. For a moment, Blackstone could not speak. Chest deep, the ice melt strangled him. Despite each man's layered muscle, both felt the water's vice-like grip and the pain it caused in their joints. A sudden fear gripped Blackstone, as frightening as the prospect of not being able to accomplish their task. Even if they succeeded, would they be able to fight afterwards?
"My balls have taken refuge somewhere behind my lungs," Moulin said, forcing a laugh as they struck out for the sluice gate. "At least you still have yours," gasped Blackstone. "I think mine have shriveled and dropped off."
Heaving for breath, they reached the wooden gate and the chain, as thick as a man's wrist, that cranked it open. The windlass was long gone, but as Blackstone gripped the slimy metal and heaved on it, he felt a satisfying give in the tension. Moulin moved to his side and readied himself to put his hands above Blackstone's on the chain.
"Not yet," said Blackstone.
He peered over the low stone wall and tried to stop himself shivering long enough to gauge where the enemy had reached. Another half mile, and the Breton front ranks would be close enough. Once they saw the water pour down the slope into the river, there would be no time for those first two rows of men to wheel their horses and retreat. Those who rode in the third rank might have time to start, but they would be caught by the flooding river and be bogged down in the marshland. Blackstone's body tensed. His mind fought the urge to yield to the uncontrollable shivering that would strip them of their strength. The rope tied beneath their armpits was already chafing.
"We count to 50, and then open the gate," said Blackstone.
Behind his thick black beard, Moulin's teeth chattered.
"You do the counting. My brain has been seized by a river god."
Blackstone nodded.
"One, two, three."
Will Longdon crouched in the shadows with his archers as the massed horsemen rode by. Earlier, he had instructed the bowmen to place stone markers every 50 paces into the path the horsemen would take, and now they rode near enough the 150-yard mark. Back from the tree line, the low branches hid them from high-riding horsemen, but the archers would soon move quickly to the fringe of the forest, and then the element of surprise would be short-lived. He glanced along the line of bowmen. Quesnel turned his head and looked, waiting for Longdon's command. Every man clutched a fistful of arrows in one hand, his war bow in the other. More arrows were tucked into their belts. Their killing time would be brief, so they had abandoned their linen arrow bags. They could hear the men's voices as they rode by. They were relaxed, some shouting and laughing. There was no sense of danger. The wind shifted slightly. A couple of the horses caught the men's scent in the forest and tugged at their reins, but the riders quickly brought them under control. Will Longdon licked his lips. His mouth was drying. He wished he was with hundreds more archers, wished they stood in saw-tooth formation between the men-at-arms as bugles and drums heralded death to the French army. He pushed the memory of the great battles from his mind. The damned Bretons seemed to move at a snail's pace. How many more, for Christ's sake? He edged a few paces closer to the edge of the forest, extending his arm to keep the others back. He crouched again. Now he could see the broad column